Welcome, my friends, to the Sage Equay Radio Hour, your home for free and critical thinking, and I'm your host, Mike Williams. Tonight, Deanna Spingola returns to the show. Deanna is an author, researcher, and radio host. She investigates government and corporate corruption as it relates to the faltering liberties of American citizens and the war-targeted populations of other countries. And as you will hear in this interview, she does not shy away from controversial issues. Deanna's recent books include her Ruling Elite trilogy, along with her newest book, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. The topic of this show will deal with Deanna's extensive research into the Holocaust, and specifically, whether the number of 6 million Jews is real, and if it's not real, where did it come from? For many, much of what you will hear in this show will be controversial, and for some, very controversial because this is a version of history you've never been taught or been made aware of, and is, for all intents and purposes, forbidden knowledge. I encourage everyone to listen with an open mind as we recall the words of Winston Churchill, "History is written by the victors." Interestingly enough, Deanna and I spoke on April 16th, which also happened to be Holocaust Remembrance Day. And so to kick the show off, I asked Deanna to explain how the Holocaust Remembrance Day came to be and to also expand on how religious dogma is the underpinning of the Holocaust storyline in general. So without further ado, here's Deanna Spingola.
Well, actually, the Holocaust Memorial Day and a lot of the other commemorative events were established as a result of the Holocaust Memorial Museum, which was created after a commission was put together, and this was built on public land, so the taxpayers, of course, had to relinquish that land, and the fees to pay for this big creation, this big building, some of it comes from private funds, some of it comes from the taxpayers. So the taxpayers are actually funding their own, well, I call it, and other people call it, Holocaustianity. And inasmuch as the Holocaust Memorial Museum also gives instructions to the educational apparatus, to many of the school teachers in this country, so that they can thereafter teach their students about the Holocaust. Well, that's also taxpayer and makes it, it makes it kind of a national religion, which coincides, of course, with the menorah that is now placed at the White House at Christmas time. It's a great big giant menorah. And so when you couple all of these things together, the special events and all of the education that goes towards school children in publicly funded, taxpayer funded schools, you have to question, well, this is really strange, because when you look at the Holocaust altogether, it is part of the religious dogma of the Jewish people, and Holocaust itself means burnt offering, and that is a part of their religious dogma, which is part of their religion. And so when school teachers, publicly taxpayer-funded school teachers, are teaching about the Holocaust, they are actually teaching a religion class.
Well, how would you respond, Deanna, to those that are listening? Because to many people, this is going to be shocking to them, as we know. But how would you respond to concerns or questions that say, look, 6 million Jews died during World War II, and it was a tragedy beyond belief, and the Jews were clearly victimized. So why is it a problem to have museums? Why is it a problem to have a Remembrance Day or a memorial? Why is it a problem to teach the Holocaust in the school system?
Well, first of all, the number 6 million is part of the so-called dogma, and it was introduced right after World War One, even before World War One. But there was a gentleman that wrote a book. His name is Don Hedesheimer, and he talked about the first Holocaust that they attempted to introduce during World War One, and they mentioned the 6 million Jews that were supposed to be killed. But then when you look at the numbers, now, right after the war ended, in fact, on May 7th of 1945, on that date, the United Press reported that the Russian State Atrocity Commission charged in an official report today that more than 4 million Allied nationals were murdered just at Auschwitz. Okay, so that's 4 million, which of course would be a part of that 6 million. But if you look at the current sign that appears at Auschwitz, then you see a very interesting change. Initially, the sign said, 4 million people suffered and died here at the hands of the Nazi murderers between the years 1940 and 1945. Okay, but now the sign says that 1.5 million, or just, 1 million, 1.5. They've changed it. They've taken 2.5 million off.
Very interesting. So the number was reduced down by 2.5 million. And it would seem to me, in order to make sure that all the numbers tie out across the board, that the 2.5 million should also be backed out of the 6 million. And if we do that, if we take the 2.5 out of the 6, then we're left with 3.5 million.
Yes. But no matter that they changed that number, today in the newspaper at numerous sites, you are going to hear the number, 6 million Jews died. So where's the 6 million come from? No matter how the numbers changed, the press always reports it at 6 million. So it doesn't matter what the numbers state. And there's numerous numbers besides the 3 million, but it doesn't matter because the press and things like the History Channel states about 6 million Jewish people died during the Holocaust under Adolf Hitler's rule from 1933 to 1945, according to the History Channel.
Interesting.
But they do report that more than 1 million people were killed in gas chambers at Auschwitz, one of the Nazis' death camps. Others included Kelmo, Treblinka, Sobibor, Majdanek. But the fact is that when you look at the actual numbers, and I've reported this in my third book in my trilogy, the actual numbers, according to the Red Cross, and they kept very accurate numbers, the Germans are very efficient. The Red Cross said in their report that came out after the war, they gave the numbers of people that died in all of the camps at 271,301. Now that includes deaths of all causes.
Right.
271,301.
So this is very interesting. So what we're establishing here is that the number of 6 million is not a real number.
Exactly.
And that the National Socialists, with their camps, which were labor camps, they were very open with regard to allowing, as you had just mentioned, the Red Cross to come in to inspect.
Right.
Something that in our last discussion with the Rhine-Meadow death camps that Eisenhower was running was not happening. The Red Cross was not allowed to take a look at those camps.
Exactly.
Right?
And the number 4 million, was actually admitted. Rudolf Höss, H-O-E-S-S. He was the commander, the German commander of the camp at Auschwitz. Under torture, he confessed to having supervised the slaughter of some 4 million people under his domination at Auschwitz. But this was under torture. He also confessed the gassing of 2 million persons between June or July of 1941 and the end of 1943. Now, he said that 2 million people were gassed. But that was under torture that he made this confession. And it came out, as I said, May 7th, 1945.
And he was tortured, based upon my research, for 3 solid days.
Right. Yes.
So after that, you're going to say just about, well, you will say anything.
Of course. You will say anything.
Anything.
Absolutely anything.
So this begs the question then, Deanna, that many now are probably scratching their heads or at least asking, so where did the 6 million number come from?
It's part of the dogma. There in the Talmud and in the religious dogma, they require, before they can return or inhabit Palestine, that there must be 6 million Jews who suffer, who become burnt offerings. And so they had to create this myth.
So it's about manifesting a prophecy.
Yes. But now, of course, they tried to do this with the Balfour Declaration. They tried to inhabit Palestine and create this myth during World War I, but people didn't buy it. People just did not buy it. So.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I read a very, very good book. Do you know who Nick Kallestrom is?
Oh, yes. In fact, I'm going to be interviewing him. I believe he's scheduled for the 25th.
He has a book out called Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, yes. Myth and Reality. I read the whole book, Deanna, and I'll tell you what, my eyeballs popped out of my head. I mean, I always found the number suspect, but I have to be honest, I was not digging into the actual details of why the 6 million number is a myth. And then Nick, in about 275 pages, lays the whole thing out.
Right.
I really highly recommend the book to anybody who's listening to this podcast to go to Amazon, spend the $20, buy Nick's book. It's called Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. And it's an excellent, excellent read. It really
right.
is. Just packed with facts.
Facts. he is a fact producer. I mean, I've had him on my program before. He is just fabulous. Just fabulous. And the Kindle version of that book is only $5. So if you want to buy a Kindle version and have it delivered immediately to your, and you don't have to own a Kindle in order to read a Kindle book.
Right.
You can read it with a program on your computer. Now, if you look at the military and civilian deaths for the world, for World War II. Now, if anybody asks somebody, well, how many Jews died during World War II? They're always going to say 6 million. But if you ask them, well, how many other people perished during World War II as a result of the war? There were 20,858,800 military deaths. Okay. 20,858,800. Civilian deaths, there were 27,372,900 for a total of 48,231,700.
And supposedly the Jews are 6 million of that.
Yes.
Okay, so we're saying here that the 6 million is not a real number, as I mentioned before. It is religious dogma.
Mm-hmm.
It is a self-fulfilling prophecy, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question then becomes, when did it all start? Do we have to rewind and go back in time to cover some period in history, Deanna, that is prior to World War II, prior to World War I, perhaps? It's up to you. I'll leave it to wherever you want to start, because I'm sure some folks are now scratching their heads and saying, well, then why did they make this number up? I mean, what's the purpose? What's the reason for doing what they're doing? I know you had mentioned before that it was so that they can basically fulfill the prophecy and get all of Palestine, but what's the lead into all that?
Well, when I started my research, well, about 1848, although I do cover some things before that, I talk about the freedoms that the Jews were allowed to have by George Washington I mean, he was very favorable to allowing them to come into the country. The United States was really, even before Germany granted them emancipation, before Frankfurt granted them emancipation, the United States allowed the Jews to settle in the New York area, in New England, and George Washington. Well, they looked at George Washington very favorably. But then you had they had a lot of influence during the Jackson administration. Jackson and his Secretary of State actually appointed the Rothschilds as the bankers for the United States to handle their bank loans and bank issue. They just let them handle their banking in Europe.
Right.
And of course, Jackson and his policies led to one of the first major economic depressions in the country, which occurred in 1837. And then you had the Marxist revolutions in Europe, which began in 1848 as a result of Marx and supposedly the Manifesto. But then when you look at some of Marx and Engels and where they got their information, it actually came from a book by Clinton Roosevelt, who was a cousin of the Roosevelt family, Franklin D. Roosevelt, who probably got a lot of his information and ideas for his New Deal policies from his cousin Clinton. And Marx and Engels borrowed a lot of their policy and practices from Clinton Roosevelt's book. So then you're up to 1848, and then we're getting ready. We often think, okay, the first Bolshevik revolution, the first Marxist revolution occurred in Russia. I disagree with that. I believe that it occurred here in this country, and it is called the Civil War, which was not really a civil war. A civil war is a war in which two factions of a country are fighting to take control of a central government. That is not the case. The so-called Civil War was an invasion by the socialist North against the South. And when you look at where the battles were fought, there were only two battles that were fought in the North. All of the other battles during the Civil War were fought in the South. And many of the people who fought on the North were Marxists who emigrated from Europe after the unsuccessful Marxist revolutions there. They emigrated from Europe, came over here, joined the Union Army. They actually were influential in getting Lincoln elected, and Marx and Engels, they were in favor of Lincoln. They supported Lincoln. They promoted Lincoln, and Lincoln won the election based on a lot of the Marxist newspapers. They came over here, established newspapers, and so when the Union went into the South, They destroyed the production, the farm production. They destroyed towns. It was, well, we all know about Sherman's March to the Sea. They killed at least 50,000 civilians. It was the first modern total war. And by total war, what I mean by total war is that the military personnel actually target civilians. In warfare in Europe prior to the Civil War here, the wars were always fought on a battleground. They were between the two parties. They didn't go after the civilians. But in the so-called Civil War, they destroyed everything. Towns, barns, harvest, chickens, dogs, cats, people. There was raping and pillaging and all. It was awful. It was awful. Terrible. Terrible.
Now,
terrible.
Deanna, some in the audience now may be asking, okay, so are we saying that the Marxists were essentially Jews?
They were not all Jews, but a lot of the people who came over here and established newspapers and were the leaders, yes, many of them were Jewish.
Okay.
And I cover that in my first book in my trilogy.
Okay. I'm going to highly recommend your books, the trilogy, to the audience as well, along with Nick's book. So, you know, this is going to be hard stuff for a lot of people to swallow because we're talking about the Civil War. And, of course, everybody's been taught that the Civil War was all about slavery.
Which is not true. Only 5% of the people in the South owned slaves. Yes. And a lot of the slaves were owned. The big plantations were actually land that was confiscated by Jackson and his buddies. And so you had a lot of people from the North go down and, well, steal land that should have been under the ownership of small independent farmers. They went down and they had a lot of the, they owned a lot of the slaves. When you look at the slave marketing, who owned the markets, who controlled the markets, who owned the ships that brought the slaves in to begin with, who was in charge of the triangular trade where they were trading sugar and rum and slavery. That was all under the jurisdiction of the people who had always done the trading, most of the trading in the world. That would be the Jews. And then, of course, after the Civil War, you had the introduction of corporatocracy, where you had the 14th Amendment that allowed corporations to assume personhood, so that they could get away with a lot of things, so that they could have some of the benefits of personhood when in fact they were not persons. They were entities, corporate entities that soon after became monopolies, and we have, well, the monopolies have monopolized, and when you consider even the public airways and the number of corporations that used to exist, for instance, during the Reagan administration, there were at least 50 different radio stations, radio companies, you know, news companies, news right. corporations. And now we're down to 5 or 6.
Exactly.
And they control all of our perceptions. Well, they don't actually control all of them. They don't, not if you're a critical thinker, then you can kind of figure out that something's going on here. But during the Reagan administration, which I do talk about in my trilogy, they changed they changed the policies. And allowed these 5 corporations to control just about everything that you hear in the media.
Right. And when we talk about the media, we're talking about television. We're talking about the movies, radio, newspapers, magazines, the internet.
Right.
You know, so that's what people have to understand. And I always explain this to folks, you know, when I get into this discussion with them, I'll say, look, it's very easy to tailor what it is that you're going to see and hear and what it is you're not going to see and hear. Essentially, 6 people convene or get on a conference call and say, we will show this and we won't show that.
Right.
You know, and I know it's an oversimplification, maybe, but that's essentially how it works.
Or they conceal things. It doesn't mean that everything that you hear in the national media is false.
Right.
But it does mean, while they are reporting on, and I gave this this example in a radio program that I did recently, when they were reporting on the O.J. Simpson trial in the 90s, in 94-95, they were the whole trial was televised. People were figuratively glued to their television sets, watching all of this stuff, and what they didn't report on was that there were also going, was also going on at the same time, the Westbecker trial, and there was 190 lawsuits against Eli Lilly, because of the Prozac deaths, suicides, violence, and that kind of thing. You didn't hear a word about that.
Yeah.
Not a word about Eli Lilly, not a word about how they bought the jury in the Westbecker trial. It was all concealed. It didn't mean that the O.J. Simpson trial wasn't going on. That was all true. But what about all the truths that they didn't report about?
Yeah, it's like lying by omission, right?
Sure.
Yeah, that's really what it is. OJ, that clearly that was going on. It was a murder, but there's a lot of other stuff that, you know, probably more important at the end of the day.
Right.
That never got any airtime.
And we're talking about two murders that certainly affected their families, affected their friends and everything. But then when you say, okay, what about the 190 lawsuits?
Right.
Now, 190 lawsuits affects a lot of people. We're talking 190 families, friends, relatives, and we're talking suicides and suicide and homicide ideation. We're talking violence. All of that was covered up. And it is the Delphi technique. The media will tell you what to think about, for how long. They will keep you focused while concealing something much, much, much more important.
Right. Now, Deanna, if we go back for a second, just a step back for one moment, back to the Civil War. So then I guess the takeaway should be that the Civil War was about a Marxist takeover of the United States.
That is my contention, yes.
Okay.
And when you look at everything that has happened, you can see the incremental transgression to communism that we are living under now.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. So what about then the assassination of Lincoln by John Wilkes Booth?
Okay. What that was, if you look at the Republicans, there was a group in the Congress, the Red Republicans. And Lincoln figured that after the war was over that he would allow the South to resume their business, try and rebuild the country, you know, their part of the country and whatnot. Well, the Red Republicans didn't really want to do that. They wanted to control everything. And so you have to look at who had motive. And I talk about this in my first book. Even his son had a part in all that. I mean, it's several chapters that I talk about Lincoln. Several chapters I talk about Jackson and some of the mythology that surrounds him. And there's a lot of mythology around both of those. I think I have 11 chapters just on Lincoln and several chapters on Jackson where I provide actual documentation. I did a lot of research. I just do a lot of looking up at stuff and research and actual documents. And the myths often are so accepted by the people that they never consider that it's a myth at all. The myths become great truths.
Yeah, that's how it works. I mean, they still apply that technique today.
Sure.
Just keep lying and deceiving. Eventually, everybody will just either embrace it or become so apathetic and, you know, so bored by it all that they just don't care.
Sure.
So then what happens then, Deanna, after the death of Lincoln and as we progress down the timeline, as we move toward World War One?
Well, I talk a lot about World War One, how it was started. It was initiated by a couple of false flags, the Lusitania being one, and we're coming up on the anniversary of the Lusitania here on May 7th, and which I will be talking about with a guest on my program, my blog talk program. But, you know, there was also, I mean, we're talking false flags. The United States is always engaged in false flags. From the Mexican War forward, they've always engaged in false flags. And they always will. And false flag event means that there will be an event that has to do with the whole country that they will, that the United States government will blame on their targeted enemy that they have to go after. Whether you're talking about Vietnam and the false flag that started that war, or the USS Maine that started the Spanish-American War, the false flag that started the Civil War. And there's always a lot of celebration after these things.
Well, you know, you bring that up, and I interviewed James Perloff.
Yes, he's a friend of mine. Yeah.
James is great. And
he's wonderful.
So we did a whole show, and I'm going to recommend this to the audience also. So I'll put the link in the show notes. James's book, his current book, is Truth is a Lonely Warrior.
Right.
And the first couple of chapters, James very succinctly takes the reader through all of these false flags that the United States has been involved in, that they initiated, and so on.
Right.
So, I mean, the facts and the evidence is all there. You just have to take the time to sit down and turn off the television set, stop watching Dancing with the Stars, and do something a little more intelligent.
Exactly.
And all of this stuff that we're talking about, you will know about.
Sure. Now, right. James is going to be my guest on May 7th. And okay. We just...
Tell him I said hello.
I will. I definitely will. He emailed me this morning, and we did a program last year on the Lusitania at about the same day. And he emailed me, and he said, hey, why don't we do this again? And I said, oh, absolutely perfect. Wonderful. Let's do it. So, yeah, he's just a great person. I remember buying the first book that he did when he was associated with the John Birch Society, which he no longer is. And I went through that. And this has been, it came out like, I think in 1988. But I've always been a Perloff fan. And whoever thought that we would be friends? I mean, I always admired his work. And so, yeah.
You do. You find friends and people... you get drawn to them because you're of like mind.
And exactly.
Right. You're seeking the truth. And I always tell people, not to digress here, sometimes I tell little stories and I'm on these shows, but I tell folks that some of the best friends I have made to date are the folks that I've met as I got into these radio shows and started talking about the truth and getting into the research and all that. So it is. It's a good thing. It's good to be with like-minded people, people who think.
Oh, it is. It's wonderful. It's just wonderful. And I feel the same way. Some of the people that I've met via the radio program, and on the internet, I've just become very good friends with them. I mean, we may never have met in person to shake hands or hug each other or anything, but I just feel like I've made some wonderful, wonderful friends.
Yeah. Same here. Same here. So Deanna, now before we, and by the way, if I'm jumping around, just tell me to cut it out. But before we segue completely into World War One, it was at this point in time, I guess in the late 1800s, that the Zionist movement became basically a political movement. It was led by a man named Theodore Herzl.
Right.
So.
There was actually a movement before that, and I cover that in my second book, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. And I talk about the Khazars, and I talk about who they are, what they did, and they started to do, they're terrorists, okay? If anybody would suggest that Jews are very docile and that they just all marched into the gas chambers and nobody raised their hand or said a word. And as a child, even as a child, when I first heard about the Holocaust, I said, well, 6 million, they just marched, they just gave up, they didn't have any, what? I can't imagine that 6 million people would just allow themselves to be destroyed.
No resistance.
Without resisting it.
Yeah.
But then when you read about what they did in Russia, and now what they're doing in the Middle East, and they're terrorists. The worst kind of terrorists. And the partisans during World War One, World War Two, oh my gosh, these people have no mercy. No mercy whatsoever.
Yeah, you were talking before about the change in tactics in war, where it moved toward going after anything that basically breathed or walked.
Right.
That was a tactic of the Khazars and morphing into what we know today as the Zionists.
Right.
So we have right before World War One, the Zionist movement, I guess, getting some traction. Am I right with that?
Right. And it started, in the 1880s. And that's at about the same time that you had the United States opening up more to, you had, for instance, the Emma Lazarus, who wrote the poem for the Statue of Liberty. Oh, and right after, we've got to include this. The Statue of Liberty. Everybody says, oh, the Statue of Liberty. Well, it was created by Freemasons in France as a gift to the United States for the Marxist Revolution being successful. Okay? And so the poem at the bottom, you know, give me your hunger, give me your, you know, your naked and all that right. kind of stuff, which really invites everybody. Hey, come on over. Come on over. Come into the country. We don't care if you're willing to work. We don't care about anything. Before the people who settled the country, a lot of hardworking Germans, and there were probably one third of the entire country was composed of hardworking ethnic Germans. Now, anywhere, anytime that German citizens go anywhere, they are going, as they did in Ukraine, as they did in the United States, they build up whatever they touch. They enhance it. They make it better. If you give them a plot of unfertile ground, they are going to know how to take care of it. They're going to fertilize it. They're going to make it better. They're going to work their bones off, their butts off to make it better. They are geniuses. I can't say enough good things about Germans.
Yep.
It's just the kind of people they are. And the Germans that came early to this country were very well settled. They were contributors, and all that changed after the Civil War. And it continued to change, to evolve, to, you know, go through the, FDR's New Deal and handouts and Social Security, and we're going to give you this and we're going to give you that. And by the way, let's formalize our association with the Soviet Union, and let us seize all your gold, by the way. And just so many things have occurred. And I always say that history is prologue. You have got to know history so that you know what is going on today. If you say, oh, that's the past, let's just get on with the future. No, the past is the future. That's only right. It's going to be much worse.
Well, you have to know your history because they're building upon the past.
Sure.
In other words, that's their foundation. And
exactly.
It's like building a house, and they just keep building the next story, the next story, the next story. So
right.
If you're going to sit there and say, well, I'm just going to start right here, you're starting in the middle somewhere.
Exactly.
And you're not getting the full picture. Now, Deanna, when people hear the word Zionist, and I had Max Egan on the show, Max and I had a great discussion on this. I had explained that a lot of folks have no idea what Zionism is. And for those that think they do, they just equate it with being Jewish, and so therefore, you know, it's not a big deal. So what is Zionism at its core? What is Zionism looking to do? What is its objective?
Okay, you do not have to be Jewish to be a Zionist. Most of the so-called Christian/Zionist churches, a lot of the big popular television churches.
Evangelical churches.
Yeah, those kind of churches.
Yeah.
They all say, oh gosh, the Jews are the chosen people. Now, in the New Testament it says that there will be people who call themselves Jews who are not. In other words, tribe of Judah, who are not. And the Khazars, as I explained in my second book, are really from a Turkish tribe. They were absolutely brutal. They worship the phallic symbol, they worship sex, they were immoral, amoral, they were the, if there had been a Hollywood then, they would have been the people who would have populated Hollywood and promoted all the pornography and the houses of ill repute and all kinds of perverted sex and all that kind of stuff. That's,
now the Khazars,
that's who they were.
They come from Europe.
Yes.
Right.
And they populated what is called the Pale in landmass. It was a huge landmass in Russia. And and there was about 10% of the people in Poland were also Khazar. Mm-hmm. And so you had a lot of people who claimed to be Jews who were Khazars who were living in Poland. And so when you look at the makeup of Europe at the beginning of 1900, you had a lot of people who were Khazars. And so anyway, getting back to Herzl, he wrote a book, and it really started before him. It started with Rothschild. There was a community that was started by Rothschild in Palestine. I believe it was 1880, 1878, somewhere around there, where they were actually financed a community in Palestine, which I talk about in my second book. And they've been trying to seize that land ever since then. And they've been pretty darn successful. And when you look at the terrorism that they are, that they have been employing since World War I in that area, they've destroyed 500 towns. They've taken over all the orange groves, all of the productivity in Palestine. What they've done is, well, it's nothing but terrorism.
Well, it's terrorism, it's genocide. Take a look at a map of Palestine in 1946. Essentially, it was all Palestinian land at that time. And then you take a look at what it looked like in 1947, 48, when the UN got involved and decided that it needed to be a dual state. Well,
sure. Yeah, right.
And then you take a look at it today. There is no Palestinian land, virtually none. I mean, there's some there. It's very, very small. So you have to look at that map, and you have to then take it in and understand what is going on there. All of the land is being stolen by the Jews.
Has been stolen by the Jews, absolutely.
Right.
So getting back to the 6 million number, I made some notes. I jotted down a whole bunch of notes. The Russians, first of all, the Russians moved the majority of the Jews from Ukraine to the interior Soviet Union for their safety. Not only did they remove a lot of the Jews from Ukraine, they also removed a lot of the food so that those who remained, and this was before 1939, would starve. So when the Germans first moved into Ukraine, the first thing that they had to do was figure out how to feed the surviving residents. Is that amazing? I mean, that's the same thing that they did in the South when the Union went through and destroyed all the food and production, is to starve the people.
Yeah.
And starvation has always been a part of the Soviet agenda. It has usually been a part of the British agenda.
Well, the Irish famine.
The Irish famine, absolutely. Right. Yep. And that was to get people to move or to starve them. I mean, there's always various reasons for imposing starvation. And one of the reasons they imposed, now you got me going off.
It's okay. I'm sorry.
They did the Irish famine because they needed, workers in Manhattan in the beginning corporation, in the beginning sweatshops. They needed a bunch of workers. And so there was a group of people in, the Rothschilds said, oh, well, okay. So we get all these people over into Manhattan. We house them and these rat traps, no running water, terrible places. And then you have the outbreak of all these diseases. And I mean, it's another subject altogether. But it was devised, okay?
That's what I was just going to say. Another orchestrated event.
Yes.
Yeah.
To do a certain thing in an area. Because, okay, there were about 9 or 10 million people, residents, citizens living in Ireland. They produced enough food for 18 million people. They produced twice as much food as they needed. But what Britain did, the middlemen, always keep in mind the middlemen, and we know who they were. The middlemen are the ones that would come in and say, okay, we're moving all this food out. Sorry, sorry, you guys, we're taking all this food. And the problem is that the Irish government decided that it would allow Britain to govern it. And this was, you know, maybe 20 years before.
Yeah.
Bad idea. Really bad idea.
Really bad.
You need to be independent. So anyway, back to Russia, back to the Soviets, moving all of these Jews out of Ukraine in for their safety. Okay? Some other facts. The Germans did not round up every Jew in Germany, only those who had demonstrated through their rhetoric or behavior that they were enemies of the Reich. And some of those enemies, now the first camp that was established in 1933, and that was immediately after the international jury had declared an economic war against Germany. Okay, which they did in April of 33. Hitler came to power legally in January of 33.
Right, so Deanna, before you go any further, I want to make sure the audience understands what you just said. The Jews declared war on Germany.
Yes, yes. Now, during World War One, I know we're just bouncing around all over here. During World War One, there was a big influx of Jewish Marxist, communist into Germany, where they were responsible for the strikes at ammunition plants in Germany. They were trying to communize the country, just as they were attempting to communize Russia and kill people. I mean, it only took 200 Marxist Jews to take over Russia, okay? And a lot of money from the bankers, and a lot of money, like $10 million from Woodrow Wilson. I know we're just bouncing all over here.
Yeah, that's okay. It's okay.
But all of this is, it's all relevant. It all lends to the picture that we come up against at the beginning of 1933. It didn't begin with Hitler.
That's the point.
The hatred of Germany did not begin with Hitler. It began years earlier in 1848 when the Marxist revolution in Germany failed. Okay, and then in 1871, you had the unification of the German states, and by 1878, you had a lot of people, a lot of German-speaking people were saying, how come the Jews are in control of all this stuff? Now, they were emancipated in Frankfurt and soon in 1809, and soon after, a lot of the other German states thought, oh, well, okay, let's emancipate them. Let's allow them to have some rights. I mean, that seemed fair, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, they probably should have reevaluated, but they were just trying to be good folk. And by 1878, things were not going real well, which I cover in my first book. By 1882, you had a meeting in Dresden of all the German or all of the European countries sent delegates to Dresden to have this meeting to figure out what the heck are we going to do with these Jews who are controlling the theater, the banking, the medical industry, the educational industry, all of these perception management things, and they're just kind of taking over everything. And of course then, 50 years later, for 60 years later during World War II, you have the bombing of Dresden, which was, I personally believe, in retaliation for that meeting that was held in Dresden, because Dresden was not a military target. Nobody anticipated that there would be an Allied bombing of Dresden. It was, my opinion, retaliation for that early meeting. So anyway, the Germans did not round up every Jew. They only rounded up those that had shown by their behavior, that they were enemies of the Reich. In fact, the Jewish hospital in Berlin remained intact, free from Allied bombing for the entire war. There were people Jews, who lived in Germany, who remained in their homes in Germany because they were just regular citizens. A lot of the people who were who were warned, a lot of the Jews who'd come in from the East, who were against the Reich, were the Soviet, the Marxist Jews from the East. They came in, they exploited the disastrous economic situation, they were picking up, property and belongings and personal, you know, pennies on the dollar. Grabbing land, grabbing businesses, that's what they did. And so, okay.
And remember, they declared war on Germany. So
exactly.
The Germans had to do something. What were they going to do? Allow, quote unquote, the enemy to walk freely and to be disruptive? No, I mean, they had to do something. So
of course.
Just want to make sure that's clear to everybody that this is what's going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, so let's talk about the gas chambers just a little bit.
Yeah.
There were no gas chambers that were capable of killing any human beings. None, none, no. There were no hermetically sealed chambers. The one that they founded, or the one that they, Auschwitz. Okay, the big building that they decided was a gas chamber had a door that opened inward. It had glass windows. It was no ceiling around the door. It was actually the Soviets liberated, and I use that word, you know, liberate, quote unquote, liberated Auschwitz. They are the ones that constructed a chimney that wasn't attached to anything. Auschwitz, according to a wonderful little book, called Auschwitz, the Underground Guided Tour, what the tour guides don't tell you at Auschwitz, Birkenau, and this is by Carolyn Yeager. It's published by the Barnes Review. It's a wonderful little book. It's got pictures. She tells you all about the amenities that were at Auschwitz, the kitchens, the music, the sports and soccer field, the swimming pool, the theater, the library. They had a band. They had, they even had a house of ill repute. They issued script to the people who worked there so that they could go to the commissary and buy product. They had recreational sports. They had plays. They had all kinds of things. Did I mention the swimming pool? Okay, so they had all of these things. They had an infirmary. They had a hospital. Okay, if they were going to kill, if it was a death camp, they wouldn't have tattooed them. They wouldn't have shaved their head, their lice-laden head. They would not have issued them clean clothing. They wouldn't have even brought them to the camp. They would have killed them where they were found, okay?
And it was a labor camp. You'd have no laborers.
Exactly. Right. Remember that Germany was fighting a war on two fronts. As of September 1, they were fighting France and Britain, okay? Then, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, you had America in there. Then you had the Soviets were lining up at the eastern border ready to invade, okay? And the only reason that Hitler went into Russia to begin with was to prevent the invasion of all of Europe. If the Soviets had invaded all of Europe, just kiss all of Europe goodbye. Okay? All of Europe. They would have tried to Sovietize, communize all of Europe. So
Deanna, just one second here. Now folks who are listening to this are going to say, wait a minute. Now you're saying that the Germans did not initiate World War II.
They didn't. Okay. You know who did? Poland. Poland initiated World War I, started September 1st, 1939. Prior to that date, Poland, based on promises from Britain and the United States, sent several sorties into Germany. Sorties is, you know, airplanes and that kind of thing. At least 8 attacks. There was also, because Poland was a newly created country after World War I, you had a lot of people who were living in Poland, a lot of German citizens who were living in Poland. And as soon as Poland was created as a country and they put in some Polish leaders who were, well, Marxist and, I mean, you'd have to read all the details. So you can't give all these details in just a few moments. Poland started the war based on promises from Britain and the United States. Okay. And who were gearing up for war with bombs in 1935, 1936. So it was Poland. And I cover this in my book.
I'm just going to kind of step through this a little bit. All right. So now Hitler didn't start World War II. So why were they interested in going after the Germans?
Okay. Here's the big deal about Germany. Hitler and his economic policies. Hitler, there were about 7 million people out of work when he came to power in January of 1933. They had no gold, no credit. All they had was manpower and the drive and desire to be independent, to build their own country. And that is what they did. The government issued usury-free money, and then they had all these projects. They built the Autobahn. They were building all these wonderful, the highway system was the first major highway system, probably in the world.
Yep.
It was created under Hitler. He had fabulous engineers. He created a culture where the worker and the business owner were on the same side. There wasn't that competitiveness. He brought all the people together. He brought the Germans together to unite in the objective of building their country. They weren't building bombs. They weren't building things to destroy other countries. They were building their country. He taught the farmers. He got experts together who taught the farmers how to farm the land, how to bring back sallow land that was not being farmed. He got rid of the middlemen, the people who were making a killing off of the farmers. He got rid of the bankers who were charging all these exorbitant interest rates so that the farmers could actually produce the things that the country needed and not be indebted to the middlemen or to the bankers. He bartered with other countries for the things that they supplied. He bartered with other countries. It was just a fabulous system. But the big thing is he got rid of the bankers. He threw them out, got rid of usury, and if other countries in Europe followed his plan and did the same thing, our world would be a totally different place than it is now. And so that is why the Holocaust, the so-called Holocaust, is such a factor in the New World Order. People have got to accept the Holocaust. Forget that almost 50 million other people were slaughtered during the war. Forget that. If they focus on the Holocaust and say, oh, those Germans are evil, evil, evil people, then you take the focus like they did in the O.J. Simpson trial. You use the O.J. Simpson trial. You use the Holocaust, the Nuremberg trials. You use the trials. You use the Holocaust myth. And you say, those Germans were so evil. Look what they did. They were killing these people, bashing baby brains out, burning people up, slaughtering them. Then you take the focus off of what they were doing. They were building. They had no intention of taking over the world. They just wanted to fix their country that the Allies had decimated in World War I. And right. After they decimated Germany in World War I, they starved them for another 9 months until they accepted the Versailles Treaty. Millions were starved. I'm sorry, I get...
It's okay. It's okay. They were coming off the Weimar Republic. The Versailles Treaty was... The financial burdens that were put on Germany were in the upper stratosphere. In fact, it was impossible to pay back. It was impossible.
Impossible.
And it was impossible.
You had the Dawes Agreement. You had the Young Agreement.
Right.
And Hitler wanted to get rid of that. He wanted parity with the other countries. There was also restrictions on how much military they could have. He just wanted fairness. Just wanted fairness.
By his fairness, he was exposing and jeopardizing the Jewish oligarch's control matrix, essentially.
Yes, he was. And during the Weimar Republic, Berlin had become the Sin City. It was the Hollywood of Germany. Mm-hmm. It was the San Francisco of Germany. It was, I don't mean to berate Hollywood, but it was anything goes. You could buy anything there. You could buy sex with animals. You could, when people are starving, people do really desperate things.
Yeah.
And Berlin became the capital city where the desperation of tens of thousands of people became apparent.
Very decadent.
He cleaned up Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And if any book burning that was done was the garbage, what they considered the art, and we know who was running all this awful stuff, all the decadence. And a lot of them left 1933, came over to Hollywood and started, the Hollywood production companies that are now putting out, mm-hmm. Garbage. To do the same thing to America that they did in Weimar, Germany. Okay, so then, let's talk about the piles of, can we talk about the piles of bodies?
We could talk about whatever you like.
Okay, the piles of bodies. It was Eisenhower and all the people that he brought over to Germany, the film crews that he brought over to Germany. He says, look at all these bodies. These are those poor dead Jews. No, they weren't. They were starved Germans that they took pictures of and they said, these are dead Jews. And when you look at the numbers and the claims, there were claims Martin Gilbert stated in the spring that in the spring and summer of 1942, hundreds of thousands of Jews were being gassed every day for 17 weeks. And if you took his numbers, it would amount to like 23 million Jews that were killed by the Germans in 4 months. There were not that many Jews in the entire world. In fact, if you looked at the Jews at the end of the world, according to their own census records, there were more Jews at the end of World War II than there were at the beginning. And yet every other ethnic population was absolutely decimated. Now, in my third book, I give the numbers of people who left Germany, the numbers of Jews that left Germany, and exactly how many Jews were left in Germany. By September 1939, Kurt Klein, who has given all these statistics, says that 282,000 Jews had left Germany by September 1939, and another 117,000 had immigrated from Austria. About 95,000 Jews immigrated to America, 60,000 to Palestine, 40,000 to Britain, 75,000 to Central and South America. There were not 6 million Jews under German jurisdiction at any time in all of Europe.
Right.
Okay? And at the beginning of World War II, there were about 16 million Jews in the world. There were 5 million already in the United States who'd come over here before and right after World War I. There were 5.3 million in the USSR and the Baltic states. There were 2.9 million in European countries that would be occupied by Germany during the war, 400,000 in Palestine and 2.4 million in the rest of the world. So if you look at the numbers, and you have to look at the numbers, you can't accept these crazy 6 million figures. It's just ridiculous. And then when you consider the crowding in the camps and you consider the typhus outbreak, and during any war, you're going to have typhus, you're going to have lice, you're going to have all kinds of things. And then when you consider, the lice and the crowded conditions, when you consider the Allied bombing of the communication system, of the railway system, you are going to have death and destruction because of typhus. And in the last couple of months before the war ended, you had typhus outbreaks. And you also, you also have to consider the autopsies. Of all the autopsies that were done, and they did a couple hundred autopsies just in the one camp, none of them, according to William Eckert, I think his name is William Eckert, said nobody died from gassing. And Fritz Berg, who I interviewed just recently and who I've interviewed before, said the bodies, if they had died from gassing, they would have been cherry red.
Right.
Now I know from my own personal experience, I suffered a very serious anaphylactic shock. And by the time the ambulance got me to the hospital, all of my organs were shutting down. I was red as a beet. They told me later, you look like a tomato. Okay? That happens when something happens to you and your organs start shutting down, which would happen if you are being gassed, all of your organs shut down. You don't just flop over dead. And some of the testimony at the trial, the Ernst Sundell trials, there were two of them.
Yes.
There were people who gave testimony and said, well, it took 5 minutes for them to gas all the people. Oh, that is so stupid. That is so stupid. 5 minutes? Really? 5 minutes. And then they would go in and clean out all these bodies. Well, what is to keep the people who were taking all the bodies out from being gassed? 5 minutes, really? With Cyclone B? That is as ridiculous as saying that the Allies used DDT dropped from airplanes to kill the Japanese and the Germans. That's ridiculous. Cyclone B had the same function for the Germans as DDT had for the Allies in reducing the number of lice among the military.
Right. It was to get rid of the lice.
Exactly. The real Holocaust were of the German and Japanese victims. They were victims of the Allied bombing. They were the burnt offerings. That was the real Holocaust. The Allied firebombings caused the live burning, a literal Holocaust of millions of people, at least 1 million German women, children, and other civilians, 500,000 living in Dresden, and every other major city with a population of 50,000 or more. And Winston Churchill and Franklin D. Roosevelt approved of all this.
Now, Deanna, the other thing too, and I want the audience to be aware of this, is that there was never ever any documentation, edicts, orders,
never
ever found that came from Hitler or from the upper
anybody else
of the National Socialists that said that they were to kill Jews.
Nothing.
One document exists.
If there were a document, it would have been produced. Okay.
Right.
And there was nothing to even suggest that there was an extermination plan. The only plan that they had was for immigration, not extermination.
Didn't Hitler also offer up a bunch of money to relocate the Jews?
Yes, yes. That was the Havar plan. And it was something that they decided to do up until a certain point, and then they thought, I cover the transfer agreement in my book. And what they did is that they allowed Jews to emigrate from Germany to go to Palestine. They set up a special account where they could take their resources with them. Okay? You will hear, oh, people lost everything and they seized all the property from the Jews. No. They allowed them to take, those that left before September 1939, and as I mentioned, several of them left, they took what belonged to them. If they went to Palestine, and there were 60,000 that went to Palestine, and most of those immigrated under the Havara Agreement. and it was, and they were allowed to sell their property and put the money in a special account. And then when they arrived in Palestine, the money was transferred to Palestine, and they hoped that, well, the agreement was that that money would be used to buy equipment from Germany. It was a collaborative effort where both, they would both benefit. Okay? And then some of the Zionists in this country said, no, 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 we don't like that agreement because it allows, Germany to trade and to benefit. So the Zionists in this country actually wanted to, well, some of them actually wanted their fellow Jews to suffer.
Of course.
Just to suffer.
Because
so that they could say, oh, look how they're suffering.
Right, right. So the thing is, if Hitler was successful in getting them to Palestine, he would have beaten the UN.
Ah, yeah.
Doing the same thing back in 1948.
Except they decided, they looked at this and said, you know, this isn't working out real well, because they really didn't want to concentrate the Jews in one area, because that, well, not in Palestine, because Palestine was already inhabited. There were other areas that were not inhabited, Madagascar for one.
Right.
And there's a book about that. I have piles of books about the Holocaust. And there are many good ones. But apparently apparently a lot of people are not reading the books that actually contain the facts. They are just getting most of their stuff from the History Channel and from Hollywood movies and from the media.
Absolutely. Well, and the reason why I bring it up, Deanna, more than anything else, is why would somebody who was looking to put up a bunch of money and relocate the Jews then turn around and want to exterminate them?
Exactly.
You know, the whole thing is just riddled with all kinds of holes. So that's why I wanted to do this show, because I think it's very, very important to start having this dialogue. It's
right.
One of these topics where people are afraid to talk about it.
Right.
You know, and I said, you know, the heck with it. We're going to talk about it.
Right. When you look at the number of people that have been killed, say, for instance, since 1990, the U.S. has killed about 3 million people, Iraqis and Afghan citizens. Before that, the U.S. Marched into Vietnam. 3 million people were killed. Those that weren't killed outright, they had their health destroyed through Monsanto's Agent Orange. they're talking about Cyclone B, really, like DDT. You're claiming that Cyclone B killed all 6 million people, and yet the United States, many of whose citizens are making these stupid claims, are promoting or agreeing to Agent Orange and actually agreeing to the glyphosates that are spread all over our fruits and vegetables and crops. And here we go off on another tangent.
No, that's okay. I put an article up with regard to glyphosate today on my blog that, you know, an MIT scientist or researcher was saying by, you know, another 10, 20 years or whatever it may be, 50% of all kids born run the risk of being born with autism.
Yes, I interviewed her on February 14th.
Oh, did you? Good for you. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But no,
wonderful person.
Nobody cares.
I know. They're just off there watching Dancing with the Stars, or they're watching whatever is on TV. They're watching it, or they're watching the football game or basketball or whatever else is going on. If you could get everybody that's addicted to those things and get them to reading, we might have a chance.
Yeah.
But as long as they're distracted by Hollywood movies and I don't know. It's pretty sad indeed.
It is. Now, the thing is, also, I want to reiterate this, that when we talk about the 6 million number and saying that what Deanna and I are saying is the 6 million number is not real, that in Nick's book, he says that number was used 165 times before World War II, and it talked about beleaguered, oppressed, endangered,
yes.
6 million, right? And I had the conversation with Max Egan. Max said, Mike, on my site, I have a link that has 265 times. Max has evidently a page where he's keeping a scorecard. So interesting. So Nick has 165 in his book, and he lists all 165 in his book. And then Max sent me the link to his website after our show and said, here's the 265.
Wow.
So the message being, and the point we're trying to make, or at least the point I'm trying to make, folks, is the 6 million number is not a new number. It was a number that was trying to get its foot in the door way before World War II ever happened.
Right.
And now, so Deanna, so then going back to Auschwitz for a second. So again, a lot of people are really going to be short-circuiting. So there's no ovens in Auschwitz. There were no mass graves.
Well, yeah, they had ovens to bake bread. They had crematoria because people do die. People die every day, no matter where what they're doing. And they needed a sanitary way of disposing of the body. So it's perfectly legitimate to have a crematoria. And something that...
But they weren't ovens that had to do with 6 million people.
No!
Yeah, okay, that's
heavens,
my point.
No. Somebody made the claim at one of the trials. They made the claim that there was smoke coming out of these ovens, or the smoke coming out of these chimneys, and that was because they were burning bodies. And Nick says in his book, he talks about the surveillance flights that were going over Auschwitz during this time. There was, and they claimed that there was pits of burning bodies and all this stuff. No, those surveillance planes would have seen this. It didn't happen. The photographs taken of the reconnaissance photographs of the labor camp did not show any smoke or burning body in pits. And this was in the summer and spring of 1944. Where this Dr. Miller at the Zundel trial claimed that the Germans burned 12,000 Jews each day. Ah, it's nonsense. Utter nonsense.
I tried one time even to do the math, and I'm like, mathematically it doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work.
You know, so now the next question would be, if I were sitting in the audience and this was all new to me, it would be like, well, this is mind-boggling. So why would the Jews do this? Why would they concoct this whole story? Why would the United States concoct this story, or Europe, Britain, and so on? So what do they gain from this made-up story?
Power, money, land. They gain control of the population through their Holocaustianity.
And the Germans are still paying reparations, right?
Yeah. They gain, when you consider the example of Germany, they retain control of a lot of markets. They sit on all the boards of the multinational corporations. They are taking over the Middle East, have taken over the Middle East, which is a very strategic area.
The Zionists control the United States.
Well, they have for a long time.
Yes, and I think people need to understand that. That's another thing, that when I have discussions with people, they look at me like I'm nuts. But they need to really start getting their heads wrapped around that.
Okay, the right is controlled by the Zionist. The left is controlled by the Marxist. Okay, Marxist, Zionist, both parties are totally under their control. If you look at all of the congressmen or the people who are running for office, they all are doing so at the behest of international Jewry. You do not run for office in this country unless you are approved by international Jewry, by Netanyahu, and by AIPAC.
Well, AIPAC is the largest lobby.
And then when you look at the medical industry, you have to think, let's see, how does that tie in? It all ties in. Everything ties in.
Yeah, everything is all connected. And, you know, it's always interesting. I when I have conversations, and I say, well, how come our politicians put a skull cap on their head and they stand in front of the Wailing Wall?
Yeah.
But we never have anybody from Israel come over and put their hand on the Jefferson Memorial and talk about what a great republic the United States is. You never see that. You never see that. It's always our politicians going there to go pay homage to their puppet masters.
Well, when you talk about a republic, you have to recognize what a republic is. And you have to recognize that, okay, the Jefferson Memorial, yeah, probably they do love Jefferson. Not Jefferson, I'm thinking of Lincoln.
Lincoln, that's why I didn't pick Lincoln. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to pick Lincoln, then I said, wait.
No, don't pick Lincoln.
She's going to catch me on that one. So I chose to pick on Tom.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, they had to get him out of the country so that he wouldn't, think of these better ideas. They had to send him over to France as a diplomat to get him out of the way. So, which I covered too, but.
So it's all power and it's an agenda. And,
sure.
It is
for the New World Order.
Right.
And the Holocaust, as I mentioned, is the biggest factor in creating the New World Order. It is all built on the Holocaust because it is the Holocaust that has driven most everything following World War II. You look at all the things that happened after World War II, and you can see that the Holocaust is at the center of it.
And the Zionists have capitalized on it like you wouldn't believe. I was watching an interview with Max Blumenthal. It was 5 minutes long, and he made a very good point. He had said that the Zionists created and have to have anti-Semitism.
Of course.
Otherwise, their entire agenda and everything that they're about collapses like a house of cards. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he had said. And I think people need to chew on that a little bit too and understand that this anti-Semitic language and finger pointing and vilification, it has a purpose.
Right. And how come the Jews have been thrown out 109 times from other countries? And even before World War II started, there was newspapers saying, okay, which country is going to take some of these Jews?
Yeah.
Nobody wanted them.
Well, it goes back to when they were Khazars, too. Khazars.
Sure. I mean, nobody wanted these people.
Very warring, very aggressive people.
Exactly.
It's just in their blood.
Yes. And keep in mind, there were 48,231,700 people that died. And 6 million of them weren't Jewish because 6 million Jews didn't die. They're not in that figure, people.
Right. And as we had mentioned before, the Red Cross records show under 300,000, right?
Yes. And that's all ethnic groups.
Yeah.
That is not, that's all the camps.
And not by gassing.
None of them by gassing.
Right. That's the point I want to make, too. None by gassing.
None by gassing. In fact, Auschwitz, let's see, 52,000, yeah. That's what the Red Cross says. That's a little bit less than 4 million.
Just a wee bit.
Yes.
So this is just amazing stuff, Deanna, and you know, your research and your handle on the facts is outstanding. And I have to tell you, I was a little skeptical about doing a show like this. You know, it's kind of, I guess I had to look in the mirror and say to myself, well, because we have been so beaten down.
Proper. You have to be proper.
I mean, it's almost like you can't even say the word Jew without feeling some
guilty.
Kind of remorse or guilt.
Mm-hmm.
But we can talk about Christians and we can talk about Buddhists and we could talk about Hindus and
everything
else. We're not a problem. We're not even blinking, right?
Exactly.
The vilification of Christians as an example is not an issue. But when you start talking about the Jews, it becomes very difficult and it gets uncomfortable. And I know a lot of people, by the way, Deanna, that are in alternative research and in the truth movement, and they still stumble all over themselves when we have this conversation, even though they know, as an example, the number of 6 million is not true,
mm-hmm.
they still kind of do an end run around the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people that claim to be pursuing the truth. That is how big this mountain is.
Sure.
You know?
I have found that when you're pursuing the truth seriously, you're going to run into it like a brick wall. And and if you don't hit that brick wall, then you're not really serious about getting to the truth.
Oh, that's right.
Because the truth is there, and once you look at it, you cannot retreat and say, you cannot ever go back. There's no going back.
Oh, that's right also. And that's another thing that I say to folks is once you become aware, once you look behind the curtain and you see the Great Oz, there's no going back to in front of the curtain. You just can't go there anymore.
You know? No. If you have any integrity at all, you can't do that.
Yeah. Well, Deanna, you've been very generous with your time. And I was wondering, you know, we talked about your books and I want to give your books some airtime. We talked about Nick's book and Nick's not even on the show.
That's okay. He's going to be on my program. It's fine.
But you have your Ruling Elite trilogy, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Could you just tell us a little bit about each one of those books, what's covered and how people can obtain copies?
They are available. All of the three books are available at Amazon. I really cannot compete with Amazon. I just can't. I have to buy 100 books to get a good price. The first book is called The Ruling Elite, A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation. You can get that book from me as a PDF file. I still have a few hard copies of The Ruling Elite, Book 2. It's called The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. I still have some hard copies of that book. The third book in the series is The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination. I have both hard and soft cover books of that. And then Sandy Hook, Screaming Sandy Hook, that is available from me in hardcover and paperback and at Amazon. And I think all the books are available in Kindle at Amazon also.
Okay. So. Now, Deanna, for today's discussion, would The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power be the most appropriate book if someone wanted to take a look at your research and get more into our discussion today?
I think the third book, The Ruling Elite covers the First World War.
Okay.
And the lead up into World War II. The third book, The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination cover World War II. And, of course, the first one covers the Civil War.
Okay. And what I'm going to do is, as I put the interview together and do the editing, I will include links to all the books so that folks, you don't have to be writing this down. What I'll do is I'll give you the links in the show notes and all, and this way you can get there. And, Deanna, your website again?
Oh, it's spingola.com.
And you have a lot of content.
Yeah, there's a lot of articles there, and people can also visit SpingolaSpeaks.net, which has all the audio files, and the other website is ScreeningSandyHook.com.
We talked about that two shows ago. That was a great conversation, by the way, and I want to let you know, I did receive a lot of positive feedback for that interview. So not everybody is bought into the other discussion point that you and I talked about in that show.
Right.
Deanna, now your radio shows, where can people catch your radio shows?
I have a radio program at RBN on Saturday from 3 to 6 p.m. That's Chicago time. And then I also have a radio program on Monday and Thursday at Blog Talk Radio. And that is from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central time. And that's 2 hours, no commercials. So anyway.
Okay. And you said you're going to have Nick on, Nick Kallstrom on?
Yes. He's going to be on the 25th. And then, James Perloff is going to be on May 7th. That's on a Thursday. And Nick is going to be on the program on Saturday, the 25th.
Okay. I'm going to have to listen to that. Even if I have to download the on-demand episode, I want to hear what he has to say.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I interviewed him before he wrote the book. I interviewed him, I think back in 2013, and he emailed me. He's just a terrific person. He emailed me, and I knew he had a new book out, and I just hadn't had a chance to look at him and talk to him, but he's going to be on the program.
It's a good book. It's a very good book.
Yeah, I bought it this morning.
Did you? Okay, I read the whole thing. I was like, holy smokes.
He emailed me yesterday, and I bought his book this morning, and then I scheduled him. So, yeah.
Okay. Super. Well, Deanna, I want to thank you so much again. And seriously, you have an open invitation because every time you're on, I know I learn a lot from listening to you, and your research is just so deep. So anytime you want to come back, I'll email you after this show. Maybe we can line up something else next month.
Okay.
Yeah, to talk about another topic, whatever it is you want to talk about. This is really good stuff.
Yeah, I'm sorry I bounce all over, but it's just all so integrated.
No, yeah, don't worry about that. We didn't bounce as much as you think we did. And, the theme of this show was 6 million is not real. I think we got...
Okay, that's good.
I think we did okay. So
yes.
All right, Deanna, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you, and I just admire your integrity and your manner of interviewing a person. I think it's just terrific.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
All right.
We'll talk soon. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And that concludes my interview with Deanna Spingola, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as I did. Deanna's website can be found at www.spingola.com. There you will also find links to purchase her books, along with a plethora of information on other research topics. And as always, I'd like to thank everyone for listening and visiting the blog, Sage of Quay Radio, which can be found by heading over to sageofquayradio.blogspot.com, or by visiting our hub website at www.sageofquay.com. Also, if you get a moment, please take a listen to my album, Leaving Dystopia, by heading over to laborofloveMusic.com. And remember, live in truth and always serve creation. It's really that simple. See everyone next week. Be safe and joy, and God bless.